You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. My guest this evening is the video artist George Barber, a pioneer of the influential British scratch video movement of the 1980s. His work has developed to incorporate absurdist monologues, surrealistic narratives and physically charged conceptual art. He's been part of numerous programmes at Tate Modern, had retrospectives at the ICA and New York Film and Video Festival, and is currently showing The Freestone Drone, a new video work and installation at Waterside Contemporary Art Gallery in East London. George, how are you this evening? Thanks for being here.
That's a very nice intro. Thanks, Morgan.
Well, it's all things that you've done, so I'm just recounting the facts.
Yeah, good. You've got a lot in there, yeah.
So I wanted to start by asking you about Georgetown in Guyana.
Oh, okay.
We'll start by going right the way back.
Yeah, no, I was very lucky because my parents travelled a lot. When they were young, they were in Egypt, for example, and they lived in Iraq and they went to Iran. This is before they had children. And also America and Canada. So they were very much footloose characters. Partly because England, after the war, few people would remember this, but historically England was still pretty broke, even up into the 50s. It was a lot of rationing. I think it was finished in 48. But they had, that was the context. They recognised they could have a better life abroad. So I grew up in a place called Iflucht. It was a sugar estate near Georgetown. And I grew up in a way, yes, a little bit similar, but perhaps not as exciting as J.G. Ballard. But I did walk around myself. There was no fear of being kind of killed or murdered.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a tremendous amount of freedom. I used to hang out by the sea. I was swimming in very big waves and things like that at age six. I had my brothers sometimes. But also I used to jump on builders' trucks and go. I was a bit like Ali G in a sense. I was a bit of a an unusual character, being I guess the only white kid for miles around. But I was in Chinese shops listening to them talk, and I could do a very good Guyanese accent at the time. I won't bother that. So I had this upbringing. There was no television, but it was all about sort of talking and walking and doing a lot of swimming and being very free. And of course, there was a lot of music around. And another wonderful memory is that people in the West Indies, where I was, if you just met a friend and you wanted to have a drink, I mean, I was only a child, but I witnessed this. People used to sit on the grass with a bottle of rum and they would sleep there the night and then get up and go back. I mean, there was no sense. No one had to get home.
Yeah.
And it was very, very benign climate. So those, in a nutshell, are the kind of memories.
It sounds like an amazingly free childhood.
Yeah, it definitely was. I was lucky,
It's really interesting that you mentioned J.G. Ballard, because my next question was going to be, did you experience a similar sort of culture shock to Ballard? Because one of the things that is interesting about Ballard is like, or this idea of people coming from different climates, I guess in a way repatriating, they experience this kind of inside-outside way of looking at British society.
That's absolutely the case. Yeah, no, I always felt, you know, when I came to England, I always felt a bit of an outsider because I had this different background. When I went to school, I didn't really understand everyone because everything was TV related. And I hadn't watched anything, but I was lucky. I was quite tall and big, so no one gave me any trouble. but to go back, I did see obviously that there were problems there in 19. There were riots and things. There were problems. So I did witness the sense of the society kind of changing and, the rights movement and that all wrapped up. But I mean, I was too young to really appreciate it. But I was once during the Georgetown riots, they set fire to it was all wooden buildings. Mm. And we were on a boat with a Portuguese captain, and we met another ship, and quite a lot of the children were thrown across by the sailors, threw them across in the stormy seas. Mm. They threw the young ones across to the other ship. And that was, I still get memories of that.
Wow.
Because you saw the waves as you went over. These big, they were nice big guys, but it's not something you'd want.
but a kind of childhood close to the elements, close to a kind of physicality.
Yeah. yeah, as I said, and it's sunny all the time. Mm. It may have affected my disposition. I don't know. But I think, yeah, it was a wonderful place to start anyway.
So you studied sculpture at St. Martin's.
Yeah, now you're jumping. I am jumping ahead.
But I guess...
I was always keen. I had, even then, I liked, if you know anything about the West Indies, everyone's customising things and doing paint. There was a lot of kind of activity and I was very much into it. And so it was always in the back of my mind that I'd be some kind of artist. And then I went to a kind of foundation in Shrewsbury, which was a small place. And then I went to St. Martin's. And the course was the tail end. It was a conceptual course called Sculpture A, and I was on the last year of it. The illustrious previous residents had been Richard Long and Gilbert and George and others. And we got there. Well, I'll tell you later, or I can tell you now. But it was... No, it wasn't such fun in a way. I think this is in the late 70s. There was a lot of guilt going on. I mean, essentially, there was society was changing so that, if you like, the euphoria of the 60s definitely passed. And people, there was a big trade union movement. There were strikes, the rise of feminism. There was all kinds of ways in which people felt sort of bad about themselves, bad about where they came from. And in some ways, if your work wasn't about hastening the arrival of the revolution, you were somehow suspicious. So I think a lot of painters had problems. And, you know, in the background, there were sort of Victor Bergen and Steve Willetts making this kind of work. So I think a lot of us were made to feel quite inhibited about what we were going to do there. I remember it feeling quite contorted.
It's quite a strange, because the 70s, like, it's sometimes people, it's like the decade people forget in a way. And I suppose the longer we move away from it, the more the 80s and the 60s overshadow it to a degree.
Sure.
But in contemporary art, it's so interesting because there were so many movements. It seemed like every week there was some liberation front or some communist allied organisation springing up. So...
And also people, the discourse at the time was much more radical and people were not so nice to each other. I mean, I remember around galleries, for example, the Air Gallery had, often had performances and, for example, Americans got a very hard time if they should ask a question or because it immediately would be about Vietnam.
Wasn't there also this hangover of the way abstract expressionism, the CIA had helped abstract expressionism?
There was all sorts of currents going on. But what I meant, I mean, to look at it positively, people felt you had to think. So art was suddenly about thinking and could make a difference. I'm not sure that actually art does ever start a revolution. It certainly can change consciousness, but we don't look... there's no way art is an assault rifle. So get that idea out one's head. I mean, basically, art is a context, a consciousness that can be about changing the world. But in a way, what I was trying to get at it was actually there was a seriousness about art and what it can do, which actually is quite laudable.
So when you were talking about earlier in Georgetown sort of customising things or being involved in the making of objects somehow, is that what translated into your decision to do sculpture? Were you thinking that your position as an artist would be as somebody who makes three-dimensional objects?
That's right, I mean, it was quite naive. You know, I had no idea what it would be like when I got to St. Martin's. I mean, it was full of people who'd read Althusser, and I was about to be destroyed.
And I guess the new translation, because that was when Guy Debord's Situation, International book was published in the 70s. And it actually influenced Jamie Reid. You know, Jamie Reid, the guy, collagist, does God Save the Queen. So it's kind of...
The Situation is... book, they came up a lot, and certainly Guy Debord. I mean, I still remember that book vividly with everyone in the 3D glasses on the cover. But it was the age of Barthes and Foucault. So I think if I remember, What is an Author? I think that book by Foucault was published in France in 68, but by about 78 in Britain, absolutely orthodoxy in art schools. So this sense of gender and history and who you are, a sort of Marxist interpretation of how you function as an artist, was widespread. But that it wasn't enabling in some ways. I did feel, looking back, it made everyone quite quiet and rather sort of unsure, because it felt as if you had no right to speak. That was kind of the way it seemed to pan out.
And then when you went to the Slade in 82, I mean, around what time did you decide to...
Oh, that's a big change now.
Liberate yourself from...
Well, I started making... To get to the video, I mean... When I was at the Slade, I didn't really know quite what I was doing, but I remember vividly seeing a truck arrive, and they had this new sort of edit suite. And it's very strange when you're young, but I looked at these sort of machines coming out the back of this van, and I just thought, this is it, you know, this whatever this stuff is, I want to be doing this. So in a simple moment, I knew that I was going to be making video, if you see what I mean. And I had no idea. But I also wanted to give you the background, was actually what it let me do was jump away from all this sense of feeling quite constrained, because I wanted to use images from popular culture, record television, and re-edit it and represent it in a different way. And it was far more about pleasure. And I wanted to bring... a sort of British fine arts school sensibility to the rubbish on television, because I kept seeing shows where I thought, well, that's a great shot. And I thought whatever they were doing with it was terrible, but I would reassemble it in a good way. And so, it's quite a nice that you should mention that, because that was a big jump then, because the 80s suddenly kicked in. If you were sort of young and hungry to do something, you were kicking against the previous bunch. And so I came out and I used disco music because I noticed, you know, my tutors hated it. So I suddenly got the strength to realise that lot were over and that something else was coming along. I was just about right. But in some ways, I might have been too early. By about 85, I think I was more famous than the tutors. So there you go.
That's the way to be. I mean, I think a lot of people, especially now, this observance of tutors and the magisterial quality of the institution is really suffocating students. And I think people are forgetting that you're not supposed to agree with teachers. They're not there to tell you what to do.
It's more difficult now. Yeah. I think rather like kind of older people listen to the same music as young, it's very mixed up. But I think, the kind of great art schools are still on the case. But the trouble is, it's hard to find something that any older tutor would think was bad.
Well, and it's also difficult to find different voices in arts institutions now. And I think what was one of the interesting things before with the idea that people were allowed to have grants was that it's a possibility of having a mixture of different types of class, different types of races, different kind of cultures being in an institution. I was thinking the other day, the band Depeche Mode.
I mean,
if you ever listen to them talk, one of them's dad was a milkman, the other one's but mum worked at a checkout. It's as if it were possible for those people with a similar social background today to be involved in doing experimental electronic music. How would they find inroads to that? And the way they found inroads to that was through art school, being able to come to this institution and experiment a bit. And I think it's such a shame that there's a wall, economic wall, that's sort of been erected by the $9,000
I think you're slightly ahead there. It's yet to sort of wreak its devastation, I think. I think going back to that idea, I think the art scene is so promiscuous and permissive that you could be doing Bridget Riley stripe paintings in one studio and the person next door kind of doing vaguely Monk kind of painting. I mean, no tutor's going to stop. Whereas when I was at St. Martin's, my word, you know, they made life very difficult for people who didn't go for the sort of macho abstract expressionist route. In fact, I can remember a lot of bright people basically just leaving in the end, being ostracized. It was difficult for for women artists too. The sense that I can remember being in a crit and someone saying, tutor saying, oh, your work's very decorative. And at the time, not really, I didn't really have the language, but you sense, wait, what's this is, you know, this is not about anything to do with painting. This is straightforward, trying to sort of, again, I kind of thought, you know, cut people aside, cut them down. So, I don't want to go on about it, but I feel that when I go to art schools now, they're much more open.
Permissive and open.
Yeah, it was a bad period in some ways.
Okay.
And so, I think we've done enough on it.
Yeah, let's move on from dictatorial teachers into something a little bit more sumptuous.
Okay,
so we're going to choose the first track to play that you've picked tonight. Do you want to just introduce it for us? What are we going to listen to right now?
Well, when I was at the Slade, it was probably not very useful if one wants to be an artist, but I got very much into Goddard. And I think, one of Le Mépri is one of my favourite films. And that, with Brigitte Bardot, it's just a really, it's quite a sort of sad, moving film. But it's also a consummate piece. I mean, no one had quite made a film like that before. So I love the way it works and some of the references and the construction. I know about how he made it. But the first piece is Camille's theme, and it's in the music by Georges Delerue from Le Mépri.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance, and I'm here with the amazing George Barber. I'm embarrassing him by saying that. But now I want to move on to talk about your involvement in, I guess, the scratch video movement. I don't know, calling it a movement, it always feels kind of strange because these things are sort of foisted on some people loosely doing something.
Yes, how the press works.
Yeah.
But I did... I did want to, I knowingly promoted it as a movement to get press. I mean, it's not innocent, altogether innocent. Also, I didn't want to call it anything with the word art in it. Because again, at the time, people seemed to be more interested in a sense of coming from popular culture, so that art seemed elitist, and so the idea of I was working with found footage, so it wasn't such a leap, but the idea of taking art, it wasn't actually in my forefront of my mind, but the idea of art, like the stuff I was making being in nightclubs and things like that, was appealing. But mostly, actually, at the time, art galleries wouldn't have shown it. In fact, I once was asked, I think Susan Hiller recommended me to send some stuff. She was at the Slade. She recommended me to send some to the Tate. And I wish I'd kept the letter because they were buying video. They'd bought some of Susan Hiller's, and I got a letter back saying that they didn't actually think it was art, which I should have kept. Actually.
You should have kept it. So just
but,
so I can.
But sorry, to get back to the point, I was interested in connecting with popular culture, and I'd worked with ZG magazine, nothing deep. I was only a kid, but the idea of connecting with popular culture and art and expanding it in that way was there, and that's why I was picking disco, using music, and I was a bit of a muso as well. So that was a step change.
And I just want to, just for the audience members who aren't perhaps familiar with Scratch Video, I'll just explain to you a bit about what it is. So it's a style of video art that emerged, I guess, in the early 80s, and is centered on appropriating material from or found footage from television programs or different media formats to do with moving image, and then reconstituting them and re-editing them so that for some people they were highly political, for some people they were just more subversive, and for others it was more about interrogating the concept of how meaning is made for television. And I should say that they were quite bombastic, and they were quite the energy, there's a lot of energy involved in them, and usually they're cut to music, they're synced to music. So can I just play what I'm going to do, just so people can get a bit of an idea? Sure. This is a Scratch Video work that you did in 1983, and it's called Branson. So I just want to play, you won't be able to see it, obviously, but what you might be able to imagine is that this piece of music has a lot of samples in it, and what the footage is kind of cut in time with the samples. So a lot of things that you see on the internet today, like mashups and, sort of cut and paste remixed things, this is the precursor. This is, I guess, where a lot of this stuff comes from. So I just, this is a clip of the audio of Branson.
So I took him out behind the bar and set him up to run a company.
Do you want to know a little bit about that?
Yeah, we'll start, because I guess the first two Scratch pieces you made, I'm thinking, were Tilt in 83 the Bruce Branson piece.
Yeah, yeah.
So this, tell us about the Branson piece that we just heard.
Well, I wanted to make a piece that made use of speech impediments, and I'd noticed that Branson, he's the same today, he always wears jumpers, and for someone who's a multimillionaire and obviously a very clever dude at making money, he comes across in a very casual, he's always saying, "Oh, mum." So I decided to put that into a rhythm. But I think it works more than that, because you've got to remember what I was kicking against, that so much of artist practice had been anti-entertainment, that it had been slow and quite difficult to watch. And so here was a group of people actually taking detritus, the kind of crappy images of modern television, and making a new sensibility. So I think if you've got that in your head, you can see why it worked, and also why it was so suddenly stolen from us, because that's the other point. I mean, I made that stuff for about 2 or 3 years, and it appeared in Pop Videos and the 19 video. And
yeah,
pop,
no, 19.
I was, the guy from Phonogram, one of them, I don't know, he said, "Oh, we got all the ideas for that from your video."
Mm.
And it wasn't just me. I mean, there were, the Duvet Brothers made political stuff, but there was a schism. Yes, they made the political stuff, and I made the kind of indulgent artist stuff, I think.
So can I ask about, because it seemed like that a lot of the stuff was centred on Brixton, a lot of, like, The Fridge had a... was it a South London thing? Or
not really. I mean, I'm sorry to say, Morgan,
but
the press were fed. I deliberately fed them this idea that there was a bunch of people in South London making the stuff, jacking their VHS recorders together. But all of it was done in TV stations, and you needed fancy gear.
Oh, you did.
And we had friends in I mean, the Duvets worked in a TV station. Mm. One of them did. Rick Lander worked in it. So that was how they did it. And they helped me with various bits. But I was also at the same time, I was freelance, and I was doing bits and bobs, and I got myself into studios. I mean, I was even a point when I was on the dole and living in a squat and saving up money to pay for time. This is how devoted I was. pay for time with edit suites and things. So it was a totally different... I mean, today, this is all madness. Everyone can do it on a little laptop. But anyway, the fact was that we weren't... We were quite... we weren't some strange subcult, but I'm guilty of promoting it as if we were, because it seemed to be a better story.
Yeah, because I mean, there's a sort of commonly cited piece, a feature by Andy Littman, which was it was called Scratch and Run, and it was published in City Limits. And this article kind of ties the Scratch video movement in with...
I'm impressed that you should have
Something that people need to read, because it's like it's a dated form of hyperbole, because he's bringing in like Scratch video, he's calling it breakdance video. So these are all these subcultural things that are in the air, and it makes it feel as if it is something that was happening in like... Cool Town Arts Centre or something in Brixton.
Well, there's no question that there's a famous anecdote about Saturday Night Fever. Mm. I think Tom Wolfe, it wasn't happening, but he wrote a story, I think, in the New Yorker or somewhere about these people, you know, dressing up and living for dancing. And Robert Salzman, I think the producer, saw the story and he made a film about it, but it didn't actually exist. But of course, once they'd made the film, it did exist. So in some ways, perhaps it came to be true in a way.
Yeah.
And to go back to the fridge, we'd seen Nam June Paik and we got basically a lot of old TVs together. And we're running four or five different VHS machines. Everything was ex-rental.
Yeah.
But it did look amazing.
Yeah.
You know, people... Yeah. I remember a soldier once came up to me and he said, I've never seen anything like this. Mm. And he was... genuinely, I could see he was touched. He wasn't drunk. I mean, I could see he was genuinely quite moved. And he said that I'm really pleased.
So it's quite interesting. When I was looking through the Scratch video works that you'd done, they seemed to develop levels of complexity, levels of virtuosity as you're going along. So when you start with Tilt, it feels quite painterly. Your sort of focuses a lot on kind of quite oceanic images.
Yeah.
But then when you get to... Yes, Frank, No Smoke. It feels very
That's
sophisticated.
My big one.
could you talk a bit about Yes, Frank, No Smoke? Is that
sure? Well, I was a muso, and I knew a very nice, still do, guy called Pascal Gabriel, who was the producer. He worked with S Express, and he's still a producer today. But he was in a band with me. You know, we had a band called the Church of Friendly Valley, which we once supported Bauhaus, but that was about as far as it went.
Were you doing pop jam with Bauhaus?
We were doing tunes, but unfortunately, I think I was the only one who could write tunes, but the other band wanted it to be not authoritarian, and we had to improvise, which was a bad recipe if you want to be successful, believe me. But to get to the other thing, so I was a bit of a muso, and I realised that if I produced, I took all the comments you hear, all the words you hear in Yes, Frank, No Smoke and Absence of Satan, they were all, each one was on a disc. A Green Gate was called the machine, and you had to feed them in, and then they were all tuned up in the studio, and then all the other samples and the music bed, everything was produced, so that by the time you went back to a TV or an edit suite to put the images back, it sounded a leap ahead of anything that we'd ever seen before. It certainly, without sounding you know, too self-involved, at the time it was pretty amazing when I first showed those things.
Yeah.
People were, they did like them. Of course, the wind was soon cut, you know, because it soon became very common, so it wasn't so amazing. But, you know, at that moment, it was as if I'd taken a Phil Spector approach.
Yeah.
It was all big stereo, lots of very neatly put together things, and then the footage came later. The mistake most people make is that they edit in the edit suite with the sound too. And yeah, you can do fine, but it always sounds a little bit similar, whereas this sounds quite moody, I think.
And I mean, what was really interesting is that in this, in Yes, Frank, No Smoke, what you were doing was having the different pieces pieces of footage in dialogue with each other that weren't necessarily in dialogue in the first place, and then also matching using I guess sound elements as percussive elements in the
absolutely,
piece.
Absolutely.
So
yeah,
can
no,
I just play?
I just want to play this well, yeah.
Quick section where we begin to hear two characters sort of having this discussion, which doesn't actually take place in the film, but the way that you've edited it together forms this conversation. It's quite interesting.
Why didn't you tell us the truth?
Yeah.
No.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
So you get a sense of the dialogue happening there, and what you don't, what you did miss is this sort of like highway patrolman who's nodding along to the yeah, no, no, yeah.
No, I thought it was a nice. That's definitely a good bit. I like that bit. Yeah.
So one of the things I wanted to ask
it's
you
a bit
about
like Bruce now, and he's got a
yeah, that's yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
Is the reoccurring oceanic imagery in all of it? Because in a lot of your scratch works, there is this the ocean features
it's
the blue.
The West Indies, man.
Is that the West Indies coming back?
Well, I am pretty keen. No, I was a big. I did a lot of swimming. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's also, in a bad way, it's actually one of the biggest cliches in video art going is people, if they think they're making video art, will focus up on water, you know, drips or whatever, you know, just a pond. I mean, it does look rather nice. It always becomes self-justifying. Because there's small permutation so that one can look at footage of a pond and be perfectly happy, but I think I was always against that cliche, so I only ever used that as a kind of keying device or things like that. I don't think I ever met someone, will perhaps correct me, but no, I think as well the colour, I'm thinking most of the time I do like a lot of colour, I mean obviously as you might as well, mightn't you?
Well, no, because I think what it does is it does kind of differentiate you from the other scratch works, which are quite in your face, and actually are quite harsh and abrasive, except for the Duvet Brothers, whose stuff is, I think, comparable to yours. But when you, Psychic TV and Gorilla Tapes, Psychic TV was the collective which was formed of Frob and Gristle members, which I thought was a lot less sophisticated than what it was that you were doing, really. And I think Andy Lippman, in this article that people should try and research and find, actually makes a distinction, because he writes, George Barber takes the innately seductive quality of TV to mix colour, shapes and movement into hypnotic, fluid sequences. The screen becomes a crystal ball, triggering the subconscious. It's TV as the dream machine.
Oh, that's good.
So that's him in full, like, beat poetry flow, referencing Burroughs and stuff. But
I think I had a line I used to say, I was disrespecting the rectangle. which is quite a good lie, but it was actually the some truth in it, trying to make shapes go outside and inside the screen.
Okay, so from disrespecting the rectangle, we're going to go to somebody who disrespects the guitar or the Fender Stratocaster.
Well, this is to do with my past. Yeah, what do you want me to talk about it a bit?
Introduce it. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, this is you know, Hendrix was a virtuoso, and I used to listen to him a lot when I was kind of 9, 10. Well, it was one of those people I just stuck with and still think, you know, this solo, he's such a virtuoso. I also think as well that people don't seem to realise that most lead guitar solos actually have a lot of connection with violin. If you listen to violin and classical music, the way Hendrix plays it, it's just the same.
Okay, so this is what we're going to listen to now is Jimi Hendrix with the Band of Gypsies, which is
11 minutes.
Yeah, well, we're not going to hear 11 minutes of it, but this is live at the Fillmore.
Just show someone at the top of their game.
Yeah, in 1969, and yeah, enjoy.
Thank you.
So in the essay that Gareth Evans wrote in your monograph, he sort of tried to categorize your work. So I just want to read something that he said, because I think it is quite interesting. He says, "The consensus on the work of George Barber is that it falls comfortably into two categories: scratch videos and a number of narrative microdramas, generally in monologue form."
Yeah.
Now, for me, I think that's a kind of interesting, it's an easy way of splitting your work. But then the microdramas, I think, then split off into about three or four different types. And one of the interesting ones is the slacker videos. And now people, I suppose, when they think of slacker, they think of Generation sort of X, or maybe even Bret Easton Ellis and American Psycho. And what you were doing in the early 80s was really interesting as well, because so the two films that I probably felt most slacker to me, one was Taxi Driver 2, which was, when was that, 1987,
I think.
1987. Yeah. And then you did the Venetian Ghost. And what I'd like to talk to you about the Venetian Ghost. So in The Venetian Ghost, basically what happens is there's a ghost that was in Venice, an 18th century duke or something, is it?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And
he ends up being suggested by somebody else to go to California, to Venice Beach.
Beach, yeah.
And it's this interesting like dissection of, I guess, the hyperreal. Like
I think at the time it is quite... a sort of sad piece, in the sense it is some sort of musing on culture, and I think by then, just to put it in context, obviously Scratch sort of blew its way out, you know, on, because once everyone was doing it, it stopped being interesting. But I'd always liked writing, so I became interested in doing narrative, and I wasn't ever happy to just stay in a box. So it may have been unhelpful to my career in some ways to have done so many different kinds of things. But it's quite an unusual thing you found that in a way, the Venetian Ghost. I always liked it, but I felt that it has this setup about, I suppose it's a sort of superficiality or the boxed up commodified world that I was feeling. And I mean, it's no great criticism of any particular place. It's just, I remember recently going to on the highway in the States, dropping off to a big, huge car park with a Barnes & Noble on. And, it's incredible. I don't know why. This shop had every book in the world. Not so many classic books, but an awful lot of books. Sort of highly gendered. A good kids section, but, like, for men, it was history of the Marines and medals. Mm. And then for women, it was, you know, exercise and recipes and kind of things like that. But it just did seem so bleak, in a way that it's hard. It's like Marc Auger, that sort of no place sense.
Yes.
And I think I was responding to, I don't know that, I think every generation has this feeling about life in the present being somehow commodified and boxed up. So you've picked, I like that work. I don't think it's that well known, but it's basically amusing on that.
Yeah, it's a great work, because what you seem to be digging or tapping into is this generation that's reared on the media and is somehow beguiled by the media into working with the media. So the guy is from an ad agency.
That's right, yeah,
In Taxi Driver 2, which tells the story of a guy who works at an ad agency and then pitches a bizarre reality television show or cooking program for terrorists, and then disappears off into the wilderness. But in The Venetian Ghost, you have a young kind of 20-something doctor who has two girlfriends and watches L.A. Law. And then this ghost is staying with him. And what's interesting is that the ghost is more real and has more vitality than the people who are alive, who are these sort of vacuous media types. And it's interesting when the ghost says, I really like this conversation, the ghost is complaining about this guy that he's living with and saying that he's always...
doesn't remember anything.
He always, yeah, doesn't remember anything, yeah. He has no memory. But that when people come over, he always talks about sex, stereo components, public figures, and how difficult it is to adopt children. And I think it's really interesting, especially, you know, Venice Beach, you've got these people who are desperate to be individual. And it's kind of like... a non-place that is desperately trying its hardest not to be.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that thing about not remembering history is it is a constant, that a feeling that in many ways the media keeps on. It doesn't suit the media to connect up with history. There's always a sense if you're trying to promote something, you are the one and only who's ever thought of it. There's no point saying, actually, so-and-so did it earlier. I mean, they're not going to follow you. And I think though I'm no great expert on it, but there is a sense in which we are a lot of our cultural heritage in British art schools, for example, where I work a bit, the sense of everything is in a blender. A lot of the great things are somehow parked. They're not necessarily in a new, more corporate ethos. And everyone knows that. The changing of the language, all these things, it tends to take away from the fact that the best kind of artists do have quite close relationships with decent kind of imaginative, caring tutors who have a sensibility or a way with the world. And that's probably the best place to learn and have your creativity nurtured. But in that film, I think it's more about a sense I had at the time of society having this huge collective memory loss, and that it sounds very pretentious, but one can't be deep unless one does connect back to history.
Mm-hmm. And then you're connecting to recent history later on, because You there's a set of films that you make which are kind of monologues that in video form, which I feel like they're kind of video diaries in a way, where this character is almost like an alter ego who's involved in these sort of surrealistic but tragicomic events, and they're presented in diptych form.
Yeah.
But then beyond that, you have these other monologues which are narrated by disembodied voice. And are generally about events that have taken place in the world, not these small fictions in a way. Mm. And one of the most interesting ones was the piece you did, which was called Walking Off Court?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fantastic, and which is you connecting with reality. It's connecting to this story of a tennis coach who has a breakdown because a motorway has been built in front of his house. So that was a true story, wasn't it? How did you... And just to say one more thing about that, is it's really fantastic because what the form of the film echoes the form of the tennis coach's breakdown, because one of the things that he does is walk in circles, and the film itself is constantly rotating. So the camera, you as a viewer, are made to perform this action of rotation. So
I became very interested in the idea that if you're terribly busy and you keep jumping on aeroplanes and you keep doing lots and lots of things, it goes without saying that somehow you'll be more knowledgeable or more tuned in. And I came more fascinated by the idea, a little bit Buddhist, but the sense of this character who just by walking in a circle could come to know the whole world. And that's really the theme of the piece. It has that mentioned quite often. It's a sense if one could stay still and if you like, be happy as one is, just to be, to not want more, one could know as much as you need to. I know it sounds a little bit religious, but it does come from something that's quite... Basically, motorways and all these kind of people on them, it's incredible. It's a testament to distraction. Mm. So that the idea of this coach just walking in circles or near the borders of motorways becomes a metaphor. Mm. And I'm glad you liked it, because it's one of my favourite pieces. I also think it reveals... Matthew Noel Todd said to me that he thought I was some kind of environmentalist on the choir. And no, I think it's true, yeah. A lot of these things do have that underneath.
I think what that also reveals is this thin line that you walk when you live in cities. When anyone lives in the metropolis, it's a thin line between sanity and distraction, because that you're trying to escape this relentless onrush of the city and of this energy and this propulsion. And what it feels like to me is that just came right in front of this guy's house. There was no way that he'd have any respite from this sort of relentless frenetic energy of the city.
But it's also a comedy. Yeah. I mean, it's not earnest in tone. I mean, it is quite funny.
It's darkly comic, isn't it? It's darkly comic. That's how we could say it, because then you develop a relationship with him, don't you? Because he starts to phone you he delivers these monologues, which
are very funny. But yeah, no, I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, and he's got a long monologue about if he'd had the chance, he would have done what Tim Henman did. And
I love that. And he actually says, if I would have spoken to Tim Henman, I would have told him. Well, he says, like,
you haven't got a chance.
You haven't got a chance. I would have told him straight.
So, yeah, I've got a lot more talking in my work than a lot of other people in the same sort of period. To some extent, actually, it's a small point, but it hasn't done me much good, because it's only really the Dutch and the Germans who've got phenomenal English who've ever shown these works. Basically, it's a no-no in terms of exports, because if you're an artist thinking of embarking on lots of wordy monologues or in English, take it from me, it won't travel too far.
Well, speaking of wordy English, I'm going to try another link into one of your the next track that we're going to play, which actually I'm not sure. I feel like we should play one of your pieces so we get a chance to play one.
Sure do, yeah.
So this is something of an exclusive, because as well as making films, which is what we've been talking to for the better part of an hour almost, you've also been making these kind of pop songs.
Yeah, I've always on the quiet written pop songs,
So what I want to play, I want if you don't mind, I'd like to play the Humvee track. George sent me this track yesterday, and you were saying that you wrote it around the time of the Gulf War.
The first
Gulf War. And for people who are around them, what you remember is the exports from America was a craze for Humvees. Just people living in normal suburban environments were trying to use these heavy-duty off-road vehicles that were meant for conflict. And also the Desert Eagle gun. There was a fetishization of the Desert Eagle gun, which was being sort of... there were lots of reportage features on it, on The Word and things like that. And anyway, this track was really exciting for me because it really reminded me of that time, especially the music. And also kind of KLF it reminded me of.
Yeah.
So should we just play it?
Okay.
Was an impressive, you know what that's called, what you were doing in the chorus then? Yeah. It's called a gang vocal. Just so you know, when lots of people do that at the same time, it's called a gang vocal. That was amazing. That really brought back.
Yeah. I had a friend help me, Rex Brough. Mm-hmm. I can't do everything, you know.
Mm-hmm. Why not? So I think now we've got time to just talk about your most recent work, which is a piece, it's a video and installation piece, as I mentioned at the top of the show, called The Freestone Drone, which is currently showing at Waterside Contemporary in East London. You can get there by just getting off at Old Street and walking up the road. But This is a installation, but which it is about drones really. But the drone in this film is another kind of monologue piece.
It can talk,
it?
Yeah.
And the drone can talk,
like Thomas the Tank Engine. Yeah,
that's what you mentioned. But there's a kind of story of him becoming sentient, becoming conscious of himself,
that's right, yeah.
And developing emotions, and then becoming an artist because he starts taking photographs of the world, like Steiglitz or something.
I think it's interesting when artists. You know, I don't have anything to say in the sense that the Economist or a good journalist would discourse about drones and think about them. I mean, it's all out there, but I've read the stuff and responded in an artistic way. And I think we started the show by saying I said that art can't ever be an assault rifle, but it can certainly, it has a right to react to things and feelings about these things. And I was reading about them and thinking that they were quite an accurate mirror image of suicide bombers. I mean, most people who are attacked by each of those things are unaware that's going to happen, are just mooching about. And it has, in the sort of categories of warfare, it's certainly on the darker side. You know, like in the Second World War, the first move to start bombing civil populations was morally. That's why Bomber Harris was never very popular, because they were just slinging stuff, ordnance all over the shop. No one knew who it hit. But as long as they were German, say, and the other way around, that was fine. But the drones are in that sort of side of weaponry, because people are sort of cleaning their teeth, hanging around in bed, but things have trapped them and they know they're there. You know, and I think for a nation, not so much Britain, but we're involved too, but for a nation to have these operators who sit in places that don't look so different to edit suites, actually, and you know, young men and women guide these things in. And the usual justification is that they're preemptive, that we're taking these people out because they're going to cause trouble later, which is not such a satisfying excuse. And then obviously if you start to, I think they've knocked up about 3,500 deaths of people who are nothing to do with the war so far. So yeah, I wouldn't say that I bring, you know, I don't really bring a new understanding of drones, but I think in an emotional way, this idea of a drone suddenly seeing the truth and disobeying orders, I think it's a very nice way of introducing people to thinking about these things.
Well, yeah. I certainly think you allow people to gain an insight into a different aspect of the idea of drones, especially the way I didn't realise that part of the reconnaissance was based on washing lines.
Seeing the
sort of different types of washing that was out. And you make the audience inhabit that idea, because we walk into an installation which is washing lines, and as the film unfolds, then we eventually learn why we're standing
in washing. Well, I thought that was extraordinary, because obviously in a desert place, everyone gets hot a lot. They need to wash their clothes a lot. So if there's a secluded house, they can tell if two or three new people have turned up, because these things patrol all the time, and that gives them the indication that someone's on the move, that maybe a small group is on the move. I guess by now they've heard of this, so I don't know what they're doing. Maybe they're all buying tumble dryers, but it does make a very good theme. So that these small, and it's the film's shot through with this sense that these small domestic things are twisted around to get you, and I think that's what's quite disturbing. And it's all done so far away that the guy who's done a successful mission just whips out of this dark TV studio, gets in his car and joins the traffic on the way home. I think that's disconcerting as well, because that's sort of war, it's war at no cost,
or virtual war.
Yes, it is, yeah. And it's morally kind of strange. Yeah, it's not very pleasant, is it?
No, not at all. So, George, we're coming towards the end of the show.
Okay.
And I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. It's been really, really great talking to you.
Thank you very much, Morgan.
So before we come to the end, I should just let listeners know that there's lots of different ways that you can keep track of what you've been doing on Studio Visit. You can visit the Studio Visit website, which is studiovisitshow.com, or you can join or like us on Facebook, which is, I guess, a Facebook address. You can find us by typing in Studio Visit Show into Facebook, and you'll be able to find the page, and you'll be able to click it and like it and tell all your friends about it. Make sure you tune in next week from 7 to 8, where I'll be talking to, I think, three of the foreign residency participants who are now resident artists in residence at Gasworks in Vauxhall. So that should be quite an exciting show. But we've just got time to play out with one final selection from George, and I think we should play out with the High Wheat Plains of America, as suggested through Appalachian Aaron Copeland. Just give us a quick intro to this piece of music and then we'll play out.
Well, when I was living in my squat, there was Bethnal Green Music Library, all gone now, but I spent about 6 months going down there listening to classical music.
And
I thought you wanted to shut up.
That's all you got time for. You've scuppered your last 20 seconds. Piece of music that you were listening to at the time. It's Appalachian Spring, and it's also conversely used by Martha Graham in a piece. So that's a bit of trivia for you. But tune in next week. Thanks for listening.